So, well, welcome to this Jags Sunday. Wow, what a powerful time of worship this morning. I was standing in the back there. And so, if you've been here before, I think we've sung that song, So Will I, maybe a couple times. I wasn't that familiar with it, and Ann yesterday at the house said, turn on this song, I want to hear it. And just those words are so powerful. And that moment where it said, as you speak, 100 billion failures disappear. And I don't know what that does to you this morning, but like that's the only news I needed to hear. We can just wrap things up right now and go on to pregame because it's powerful. So, well, again, welcome. My name is Dan. I'm one of the leaders here at Ocean City. It was kind of great this morning to see Derek come up and do the announcements, and I'm coming up and doing the speaking, so it's a little bit reversed. But so I know who's excited about Jags game today. Let me hear you out there. All right, it's a big day for Jacksonville people, and I know last week was an incredible game. How many people saw that game last week? So, you know, we beat Pittsburgh. We, you know, carried it out at the end. But I wasn't here last week. We weren't at church. We were out of town, and so I didn't have an opportunity to watch the game. And so I had this crazy idea that I was going to tape the game and then somehow be able to go through the remainder of the day and not hear what the final score was and then come home and watch the game. Well, that didn't work at all. As you can imagine, social media was blowing up and I was getting texts and all that kind of thing. But when I got home, though, I still had the game taped. And so I decided I was going to watch the game anyway after I got home, even though I knew the outcome. In fact, my son John comes into the room. He's like, didn't they play this game last week? Like, it's weird when you're a football fan. We were watching replayed games. But what I found was I enjoyed watching it so much more, knowing the outcome already. So when a bad play happened, I'm like, it's okay. We win. Doesn't matter. The bad play doesn't matter. When the other team would do something good, I was like, it doesn't matter, we still win. So this wasn't the case, however, with my beloved Georgia Bulldogs. So the college football national championship a couple of weeks ago, Georgia lost, played a great game, but lost. It was a hard-fought game. Georgia had some great plays in the game, but they keep replaying this game over and over and over. So as I'm flipping through channels and all of a sudden, oh, there's the national championship. Oh, great play, Georgia, but it doesn't matter because we still lose. Now, I know I have a lot of Florida fan friends in the house, and I know for you it's a little bit different. It's like even when you see Georgia do a good play, you'd say, it doesn't matter. They still lose, right? That's okay because you have sin in your heart. We'll deal with that later. So we're in a series called Come and Listen, where we've been walking through the Old Testament, and this is the third week in a series in the book of Ruth. And so Ruth is really like that idea of going back and watching the game, already knowing what the outcome is. Ruth is a glimpse of what happens at the end. And so we're heading into the Old Testament here, looking at this story, and as we look at it, it's going to give us a glimpse of the end. And it's really happening in the midst of a depressingly dark time in Israel's history. So it's the time of the judges, and it's just not a good time for Israel. In fact, the book of Ruth is actually the first time that we see the word hope used in the Bible. First time that we see the word hope used in the Bible. And it's not the kind of hope like we're hoping that the Jags win today, right? It's not something that we're unsure about, but something that we're very sure about. It just hasn't happened yet. It's something we look forward to with expectations, and it reshapes. If you think about it, when you're hoping in something and you already know it to be true, you're just waiting for it to be carried out, it changes how we operate in the here and now. It changes our perspective on things, how we look at things, how we view our circumstances. So let's recap quickly where we've been in Ruth. So the book starts out with Elimelech and his wife Naomi, along with their two sons, going to Moab to escape famine. No sooner do they get to Moab, Elimelech dies, and the two sons marry Moabite women, Orpah and Ruth, and then the two sons die. So the very thing that they were trying to avoid, they found when they went there. Orpah returns to her land, but if you remember the story, Ruth tells Naomi that great verse or set of verses in chapter 1, you've been to weddings, you probably heard this, where Ruth tells Naomi, "Where you go, I will go. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God." So then chapter 2 puts us back into Bethlehem. They've now returned where Naomi and Ruth are doing the only thing that they can do to survive, and that's to glean in the fields. And what gleaning was, when people harvested their fields, they left the corners unharvested so that that poor people could come in and reap from their harvest or glean the fields. And so they did that. Naomi and Ruth did that Ruth did it really for Naomi, because Naomi was a little bit older, but did that so that they could eke out an existence. Well, it just so happened, and I say that term loosely, like it just so happened that she was gleaning in Boaz's field. And Boaz has been, I laugh saying it just so happened, because you'll see, like, this is not a coincidence, the fact that she was gleaning in Boaz's field. And we'll find out today really more about Boaz. But what we've seen is we've seen him be extremely kind to Ruth, extremely gracious to her. As he saw her out there, he was concerned because a Moabite woman or any Moabite person could be killed out there because they were the enemies of God. And so he tells her, you know, come in with my workers so that you can be protected. And so we're going to pick up the story where Derek ended last week, starting in Ruth chapter 2, verse 17. So if you brought a Bible, that's where we're going to start today, although it'll be on the screens so you can follow along. So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. Then she threshed the barley she had gathered, and it amounted to an ephah. Now an ephah is about 30 pounds, so this is a lot of grain. She carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gathered. Ruth also brought out and gave her what she had left over after she had eaten enough. Her mother-in-law asked her, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one whose place she had been working. "The name of the man I worked with today is Boaz." I just love how that flows through, like, just Boaz. You can just see the flowing hair and the music cue. "Boaz," she said. "The Lord bless him," Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. "He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead." She added, "That man is our close relative. He is one of our guardian redeemers." Now let's talk about that word redeemer for a minute. So in those days, if you were in debt, your property was deeded out to someone else in order to pay off your debts. But here's the deal. You had the right to buy back the land at any time. You just had to have the money to do it. And if you couldn't do it, a family member could do it for you. And this person was called a kinsman redeemer. The Hebrew word for kinsman redeemer is called goel. So let's think about this word goel. A goel could restore property, purchase someone out of slavery, ensure justice is served for the relative or for the family of the relative. And this is defined by God and set up by God as a law in Leviticus chapter 25. So in this case, what Naomi is saying is that Boaz is one of our goels. Now, I think we can all relate this morning, and as we move into the story, just kind of think about a framework around this. I think we can all relate this morning to the fact that hopelessness breeds bitterness. And hopefulness helps us to dream and think up ways to do good. It's hopelessness, and I know for me, times in my life when I felt hopelessness, it makes me feel like I have to elicit pleasure for the moment, something that I can grab a hold of that's just going to get me by. It's the moments when addictions seem to come alive in our lives, these seasons of hopelessness, something that makes us feel good in the moment. But hope, based on the confidence that a sovereign God, meaning he is in control of all things, that confidence in a sovereign God is for us, that doesn't that give us, that free up more of like this thrilling impulse to go and do something big, to dream big? Our eyes become open to what God's doing around us, and we act, like we actually take action. And we'll talk a little bit more about this idea of what hopelessness does to us versus hopefulness. So that's the first thing I want us to see this morning, is that even if we're in the middle of a bitter circumstance where we feel like God has dealt us something, dealt me a situation, dealt me a circumstance, dealt me a relationship that's just created hopelessness or bitterness in my life, we can still be hopeful. Because even in this story, remember, do you remember Naomi's bitterness at chapter 1 when she returns to Bethlehem, and her friends see her and they say, Naomi, and she says, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara. And the word Mara literally means bitterness. And she says, call me Mara because the Lord has dealt with me bitterly. And so we see where, starting out, she feels as though God has made her life very bitter, but now we read he has not, in verse 20, he's not stopped showing kindness to the living and the dead. So it opens Naomi's eyes to the fact that God has been at work this whole time, even though I felt like I was just being dealt bitterness. And it was bitter. It was hard. I mean, think about that life that they had to live. It's no way anybody would want to have an existence. But now it's just the idea that God is showing up and he's been working all along. So let's pick up the story in Ruth 3, starting in verse 1. One day, Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi, said to her, my daughter, I must find a home for you where you will be provided for. Now Boaz, with whose women you have worked, is a relative of ours. Tonight he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Wash, put on perfume, and get dressed in your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you are there until he's finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he is lying. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do. Ruth says, I will do whatever you say. So a couple of things stand out here. One is that Naomi has got a plan, right? The other is that it's a very strange plan, right? I mean, talk about this in a second, but the fact that she has a strategy at all tells us something. People who feel like victims don't often make plans. As long as Naomi remained that bitter Mara, she had no plans about her future. It was just living day to day. Some of you here have heard my story, and I've battled with depression probably the better part of my adult life. It's really tough, and I know some of you have been dealt that bitter pill too and are dealing with that. But one of the effects it's had on me is an inability to think about the steps I need to take, and an inability to move purposefully into the future, and the inability to even get up and do what I know I've got to do that day, to think and to be strategic about the future. I can remember, and I was thinking back this week when I was working on this, a year ago at this time, I was jobless, had been jobless for a few months, had no real prospects, and at times, if you've ever been in that situation, you can feel hopelessness pretty quick. In fact, I call it the slippery slope, but you start out with like, okay, I don't have a job, I'm never going to get a job, by never getting a job, I'm never going to work again, I'm never going to be able to support my family, we're going to go hungry and starve and die. And so you see how our thinking sometimes, like the fact that I don't have a job and I'm jobless now, like all of a sudden I'm going to die. Like that's a pretty drastic, but that's what our mind does oftentimes. And I'd get up and I'd say to myself that this is just how it's going to be. This is how my life is going to be. I'm 43 years old and I'm never going to work again. But do you see how this hopelessness affects how we think about the future? So when Naomi awakens to the kindness of God that she talks about in verse 20, the overflow of that is what, and John Piper calls this, and I love the name for it, but the overflow of that is what he calls strategic righteousness. And by righteousness, he means a zeal for doing what's good. So a righteousness meaning a zeal for doing what's good. Strategic meaning that there's intention, there's purposefulness, there's planning. Now, the strategy that she comes up with is odd, to say the least. It's clear that her intent is to win for Ruth a godly husband, and that's what she wants to do here. But everyone is thinking, including us here this morning, probably including Ruth, where do you suppose that this will lead, Naomi? We find the answer in verse 4, and it took several times reading this and kind of going back and looking at it, but in verse 4, she tells Ruth, he will tell you what to do. Now, one thing's clear and one thing isn't clear. What's clear is that Naomi wants to get Boaz to marry Ruth. What's not clear is why she would go about it this particular way. I mean, I think to myself, there's lots of other ways to do this. Why not a conversation? Hey, Boaz, so it's, you know, she's been in your field, you've been kind, we know you like her, she likes you, you're one of our kinsmen redeemer, hey, let's make this thing happen. You know, like all good mother-in-laws do, right? or, you know, I was thinking, like, pass a note, right? Just put two check boxes on there, one for yes and one for no, and then she sends it back, hey, all's good, or he sends it back, everything's good. So I'm wondering if Naomi even thought about the fact that this might backfire on her, that this plan might backfire and ultimately drive Boaz away. Or, I mean, let's look at the scene. We'll talk more about this in a second, but, like, you know, there's also the possibility that they could have had sex with each other, which, you know, would have ruined kind of the direction that things are trying to go here. Or was it that Naomi was so sure of Ruth and Boaz that she knew that they would treat each other with perfect purity? Now, I don't know. We're only speculating what Naomi was thinking, but it's possible that that was her thought, that she knew these people so well that she had no doubt that the right thing would happen. So let's pick up the story in verse 6. She went down to the threshing floor and did everything her mother-in-law told her to do. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking, he was in good spirits. He went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. In the middle of the night, something startled the man. He turned, and there was a woman lying at his feet. Now, just imagine this for a second. Like, if I get startled in the night by something, like, it takes me 5 minutes just to get the sleep out of my eyes and figure out where I am. And so, you know, this moment, he's startled, and she's sitting right there. And he says, "Who are you?" I am your servant Ruth, she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family." As I read this, part of me is like, all right, if this is a movie that I'm watching with my family, this is the point where I say, kids, turn your head or, you know, cover your eyes because, you know, something about to go down. But what we get is a stunning scene of purity, integrity, and a lot of self-control. We talked about it from Naomi's perspective, so let's look at Ruth's perspective real quick in all this. In verse 5, she tells Naomi that she will follow her instruction. I will do what you told me to do. But she really does more than that when you look at the story. Naomi said that he will tell you what to do, but before that happens, Ruth tells Boaz why she's come, right? She said, I'm your servant, Ruth. Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a guardian redeemer of our family. She's not just going as sort of like, I'll appease my mother-in-law and go and do this thing with Boaz. She's not doing it to be Naomi's pawn, but she's gone willingly and has taken the initiative to make clear why she's there and what her intention is. She's telling Boaz, you're the one that can redeem us, and I want you to fill that role for me. Now, this language of spread your garment over me, we interpret this to be an ask for marriage. And so when she says, spread your garment over me, what she's saying is, I want you to marry me. But if we peel that back a little bit and dig into that further, this word for garment that's used, the original Hebrew word, is the same word for wing. And it's a word that's only found one other place in Ruth. Derek read it last week in chapter 2, verse 12. Boaz says to Ruth, may you be richly rewarded by the Lord, under whose wings you have taken refuge. Same meaning there. And so we saw in the story before that Boaz was really God's agent of really reward to Ruth as that relationship began to strike up. She asked Boaz, why have I found favor in your eyes? Why have you been so kind to me? And Boaz answers, because you have taken refuge under the wings of God. And now Ruth is saying, I want to put myself under your wing. And so the language that they're using in the narrative, really it's subtle, but it's very profound and powerful. So we looked at Naomi's perspective, we looked at Ruth's perspective, now let's look at Boaz's perspective. And we'll pick up the story here in verse 10. The Lord bless you, my daughter, he replied. This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do all that you have asked. All the people of my town know that you are a woman of noble character. Although it is true that I am a guardian redeemer of our family, there's another who is more closely related than I. Stay here for the night, and in the morning, if he wants to do his duty as your guardian redeemer, good, let him redeem you. But if he's not willing, as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. Now, I want to make sure that we set the scene and understand the weight of this moment. It's midnight, okay? They're laying out under the stars. She's sitting now at his feet, covered in his garment and his cloak. They're staring into each other's eyes. It's obvious that they love each other. He loves her, she loves him. But yet we see this incredible show of self-control. And I do mean incredible. Okay, cast yourself into the scene. What happens? He lets her know that there's someone else closer. And until that person gives us the okay, then it's not okay for us to move forward with this. I mean, wow. What a man. What a woman. What a powerful moment. And I think all too often, we take the approach of, hey, if it feels good, do it, right? That's kind of how we think about things. That's how the world thinks about things. We exchange the truth of God, like I talked about before, for that illicit pleasure for the moment. And I know everybody here has heard sermons about, you know, that sex outside of marriage is wrong. And you probably had a lot of guilt heaped on you if you did it, and a lot of guilt heaped on you if you were even thinking about doing it. That's not really what I wanted to do this morning, so I'm not going to do that. But what I can tell you is that the church is full, and the world is full of regret over moments where self-control wasn't exercised. Righteousness wasn't pursued. There wasn't given an opportunity for the affairs to be put in order before taking that step. And so being able to make the right decisions in those moments, and I implore you young people, you know, think about this, think about your purity, but those moments are really rooted in the hope that God has something better for us. You see, their hope was in something greater in that moment. They knew something greater was happening. It wasn't about just, hey, let's feel good. We've got tonight. Who needs tomorrow, right? Let's make it last. All right, I won't go into that. But that's sort of like, you know, that would be how the world and most of us would look at that situation. But the fact that he said, you know what, we got to make sure that we do this the right way. If we're going to, I just think it's an incredible show of integrity and obedience. And remember, so they're hoping in something better. Remember we said what hope is earlier. It's something you're sure about. It just hasn't happened yet. And so here, Ruth and Boaz are taking refuge together in the shadow of God's wings, knowing that waiting for that right time is the right thing for them to do. I want us to look at, as we kind of close this morning, I want us to look at Psalm 36 together and really expound on the idea of this, how, you know, Boaz was friendly and kind to Ruth and saw her as, the attraction was because she was under God's wing, and that they're trusting God by putting themselves under God's wing. And so what does that really mean? So Psalm 36 says, your love, Lord, reaches to the heavens, your faithfulness to the skies. Your righteousness is like the highest mountains, your justice like the great deep. You, Lord, preserve both people and animals. It's proof that all dogs go to heaven right there. Let's hear this part. How priceless is your unfailing love? Remember last week, Derek gave us a picture of God's unrelentless love towards us, and it pulls us out of shame. And so, how priceless is your unfailing love, O God? People take refuge in the shadow of your wings. And that unrelentless love for us is living a life in the shadow of his wing, of his protection, his spirit. We think about, you know, when Jesus left earth and God sent the Holy Spirit in Acts, that Holy Spirit is part of that wing that protects us. One of the fruits of the Spirit is self-control. And so it's because of God's Spirit, it's because of him putting his wing over us that we're even able to make the right decision in a moment. So not to give away the rest of the story, Derek also mentioned last week that Ruth is in the line of Christ, which is really amazing how this story plays out in relation, again, to the bigger picture, the fact that we see a glimpse of the end. Ruth and Boaz gave birth to a son. His name was Obed. Obed had a son, Jesse, and Jesse has a son, David. David wrote that psalm that we just talked about. And David is also in the direct line of Christ. You see, this story points us to a greater Redeemer. So as we look at the kinsman Redeemer, as we look at Boaz being able to take on that role, it helps us to point, and it points us towards a greater Redeemer in Jesus. So like Ruth, he left his father's throne in heaven. Like Boaz, he not only paid your debt, but he unites with us so that all of his wealth, all of his righteousness, everything that he gained, everything that he had, became ours. And he says, so remember Naomi, remember what Ruth tells Naomi, where you go, I will go, your people will be my people, your God will be my God. And where I die, or where you die, I will die. But Jesus says, I won't even let death separate us. I won't even let death separate me from you. And he welcomes anyone and everyone into the shadow of that wing. That's where hope is found. And so I don't know where you are this morning, whether you felt like you've been dealt a bitter pill, or whether you're in a hopeless, what feels like a hopeless situation. But I want you to find encouragement in the cross today, knowing that he knows your situation. He lived through it. And he went far. The beautiful thing about this story is the fact that here's an outsider, Ruth, who's brought into the story of God. From Moab, descendants of Lot, God's enemies. And she's brought into the story of God as a believer. For us this morning, there's great hope that he goes to the farthest places, no matter how far we think we've strayed, and he goes to those places and he plucks us out. And he brings us under his wing. And so we're going to respond and worship this morning. Then we're going to have an opportunity to do prayer ministry together. So I encourage you to stand as we worship. Just pray for us real quick too. Father, we thank you for how you have come to radically change our lives. God, we just think about this story and how a man and a woman could be so faithful to something, but God, we see that faithfulness is rooted in a belief and a wholehearted hope in who you are, that you come to redeem, that you come to restore, and God, that our greatest hope this morning would be hoping in what you could do with our lives, God, entrusted to you. And so this morning, we respond to that. And God, we say, cast your wing over us that we may know what it's like to be in that place again, and that we would live our lives in that place.